All right, well, it's time to get back into the saddle.
Yeah.
Because we haven't recorded in, like, 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So it's the
other one, but...
We got to get used to how to do a podcast. Not really, but...
No. We're pros at this point.
It's our first recorded podcast of 2021, or that we've Wild. Recorded in 2021.
Yeah.
Welcome to the future.
Woo!
Hello, welcome to this week's episode of the Seasonal Anime Checkup OVA. It's a podcast where we have conversations about video games, anime, and manga. I am Jared, joined as always by Doc Al and Ladium.
Hello.
This is episode number 211.
Wow.
100 episodes from now, we'll be able to tell you about Amber being the color of our energy.
It's true. I hope you're looking forward to that, guys.
Exactly.
Stay tuned.
So we got some video games to chat about today. We got a lot of video games over the next couple of weeks, probably, that we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
That we've played over the last, like, month or so.
Yeah.
We'll get to all those eventually. But for now, we're going to talk about two major ones that we played.
We're taking it in chunks.
Of the break. We played Donkey Kong Country 3, because that came out on the Super Nintendo Entertainment System for Nintendo Switch Online Super Nintendo Entertainment System.
What's the subtitle for it?
Dixie Kong's Double Trouble. Yes. And also, we're going to talk about Kentucky Route Zero.
Yes.
Because you finally played it after I was like, hey, this is my game of the year. And you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, and I got it for like $5.
Yes.
So I was like, yeah, if Jared thinks that it is that good that it's his game of the year, I got to give this a shot.
Mm.
So I did.
But first, we're going to dive into DKC3.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, this just recently came out on the Switch Online stuff in December 18th, 2020, to be exact. The final game in the Donkey Kong Country trilogy for the Super Nintendo. Also, one of the latest Super Nintendo games probably released for the system.
Right.
Because this game was released on November 18th, 1996. In the U.S. first.
Wild.
And then came out in Japan 5 days later on the 23rd of November. And then for PAL regions on December 13th, 1996.
And 96 was when Mario 64 came out, right?
Yeah. So by that time, the N64 was out. The PlayStation was out. The Saturn was out.
Yeah, there's an N64 in the background, and what's her name, the grandma
Wrinkly, yeah,
Wrinkly, and her and
she
in
does
her,
have an
in
N64
her
in her hut. Yeah, it's real weird.
And she's playing Mario 64
real
at one
weird.
Point.
It also came to the GBA on November 4th, 2005, and Europe 7th in 2005, and November in North America, and December 1st, 2005 in Japan. And was put out on the Wii Virtual Console, the Wii U Virtual Console, and then now finally the Switch Online Super Nintendo doohickey stuff. Graphically, it looks exactly like what you would think. I mean, it looks probably better than DKC1 did. I think, like, obviously, by this point in time, they have kind of nailed down how to make, like, really interesting backgrounds and stuff, and how to, you know, utilize the silicon graphics technology that they've been using. But it is another DKC game.
One thing that we can both definitively say, I think, is that there's a lot more variety to the stages in this.
Mm-hmm. And to boss fights
than there were in the past two, which
yes.
was nice.
True. Let's talk about some development and release history real quick, because it's only like two paragraphs.
Okay.
Development of Dixie Kong's Double Trouble began shortly after the release of Diddy's Kong Quest, utilizing the same silicon graphics and advanced computer modeling rendering technology as its predecessors, in which pre-rendered 3D animations are turned to 2D sprites. Rare founder Tim Stamper retook the role as the game's director, whereas Rare staffers Andrew Collard and Paul Weaver designed the game. The game's soundtrack was composed by Evelyn Fisher and David Wise, with Fisher producing most of the game's music. A port was later released for the GBA on November 7, 2005, which includes a new soundtrack composed by Wise. The team originally had a vague hope to have both the original and the new soundtrack in that version, but this proved unfeasible due to cartridge and time constraints. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yep.
The game also had included an unlockable Christmas theme for the bonus levels by entering
That's
Mary.
How we played it.
Yes. By entering Mary on the file select screen, the stars and bananas will be changed to bells and presents, and the background music will change to Christmas music. A very weird cheat code, but that's a thing that's in this game.
It's very weird, but it was very funny.
Yes.
Which one thing that is worth mentioning is that the music is not as good in this.
Yeah.
It is not as good. But it's also hard to follow up the first two.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we did play with the Mary code, and we also cheated, so we didn't actually have to do those. So I kind of got us in the foot on that.
It's fine. We went into a few of those regardless, just to see what they were about. So
yeah,
it's not like we missed out on all of them. While the game sold over 3.5 million units worldwide, it's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It has been suggested that its sales were hurt by its November 1996 release, which was when the Nintendo 64 console had the majority of the hardcore Nintendo fanbase's attention, which, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
1.7 million copies were sold in Japan, and 1.12 million copies sold in the United States. Yeah, again, like we said, the N64 coming out is going to definitely put a hamper on that. I'm trying to see how well this did compared to the other DKC games in terms of sales. Because obviously this is probably going to be the lowest of the three, given, you know, when it came out and everything, the N64 being out. And also there's could have been probably some like fatigue with the series at this point, since this is the third game in 3 years. So it wouldn't be surprising if it was just like, I don't want to play another DKC game. Because that would be bad. Hello, Al. Welcome back after technical difficulties.
Yep. Hi.
I did some rambling there about why this game might not have sold well.
Oh, okay. What did you conclude?
The N64.
Yep.
The N64. probably also, like, there was probably fatigue with the series, I would assume, by this point.
Yeah.
Regardless of that, it's still the 10th best-selling Super Nintendo game of all time.
That's impressive.
That is. For clarification, DKC is the third best with 9.3 million units of sales. DKC 2, sixth best with 5.1 million. And then DKC 3 is 10th with 3.5. So obviously that is a big drop off from like DKC 1 and DKC 2.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it still sold pretty well. It sold better than Final Fantasy 6 per se.
Oh, wow.
By only like 90,000 units.
Yeah, but still, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I definitely remember getting this as a rental from the tanning place.
Sure.
Yeah, our rental store in my hometown was also in the tanning place.
Neat.
So, you know, all your games would always smell like tanning lotion, but...
Awesome.
I remember renting this many times.
I owned this game. I owned all the DKC games at this time because... The Super Nintendo was the primary console in my household until, like, 98 when we got a PlayStation.
Mm-hmm.
So this was still, like, a big, like, oh, there's a new Super Nintendo game.
Ooh.
It's DKC. Ooh. Those games are great.
Yes, they are.
So I definitely had this for a while. Yeah. I feel like this one, I remember a lot of, like, the weird secret stuff in terms of, like, how, like the funkiness of, like, where they put in, like, oh, here's a thing you got to do to unlock this thing and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But which is probably due to the fact that, like, it was the last game or the latest game in the series put out. So, like, that's going to stay in my memory probably better than the other two. But I think the one thing that we kind of came away from this is that, like, this game feels... I don't know if it was just because of how we played it, but, like, it felt way shorter than the other two, even though, like, it's about the same length.
Yeah, we actually put more time into it, but it felt way shorter.
Like, we beat it in, like, a... Did we beat it in a sitting or two sittings?
A sitting.
Which is very wild.
Yeah.
Which is... why do you think that is? Why do you think it felt so much shorter compared to the others, even though it took us longer to technically beat this game than the other two?
I mean, I'm not sure. I think that... Part of why we were able to actually do it in one sitting, whereas we weren't with the other ones, was because of the variety, because it wasn't as, like, monotonous.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't as horribly frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
Although we did not 100% it.
No, I mean, we didn't 100% the other two games either.
No. We I don't know why it felt so short. Maybe because we did it in one sitting.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like I said, the reason that we split the other ones up was because we got so frustrated at points that we just had to take breaks.
And I think as well, like, it feels like they toned difficulty down on this game a little bit.
Yeah.
Which I think helps as well in terms of, like, make it so you can keep going and keep going. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. I think, like, there's so much variety in this game, compared to the other two, where, like, every world feels different. Like, there's so much, like, variety and level design, and especially with the bosses. Like, there's no repeat boss in terms of, like, oh, it's just here's a reskin boss from earlier in the game or anything like that. Like, all the bosses have, like, unique mechanics and everything. Or if they do repeat, it's just, like, here's something new we're adding to the table that's, like, completely different from what, like, the original version had.
Yeah.
And it definitely helps you in terms of, like, oh, I want to keep going and see what they do next in terms of this, and this. It may have also helped that, like, we kind of cheated with the bonus coins. So we didn't have to, like, go and grind out bonus coins for a good long while near the end, which we probably would have had to have done.
Yep. But yeah. I found out that there is a cheat code called water. Mm-hmm. And if you put in the water cheat code, then you can just swim into the waterfall at the beginning and get all the bonus coins.
I was like, sure, why not? Let's do that.
It took some pressure off of us, at least.
Yeah. But yeah, like, it's a very... It definitely, I think, like you said, just helps that there's so much just to do in this game. Not that, like, there's a ton of levels, per se, but there's, like, just so much in terms of, like, oh, there's, like, just different things to do.
Yeah.
And also, like, there is the bonus world that is the harder version of the levels if you want to challenge yourself in that way.
Oof.
Which some of those levels are indeed challenging. So, like, there is still some of that, like, you know, Donkey Kong difficulty that has permeated in the series throughout the other two games. And that shows up in that secret level, in that secret world, per se. But, like, even then, like, we were able to get through those relatively...
Yeah, there was just one that we really abused save states in.
Well, it also didn't help that, like, we beat the game.
Yeah.
We beat the non-hard boss, and we went back in and to our save, and it reset all of our lives.
Yep.
So that kind of, like, hurt us, because we had banked up a lot of lives in the regular game, and then it was like, oh, no, those are all gone, so tough luck. And it was like, oh, crap, we better use save states here.
Yep, yeah. We had a lot of lives, and then we went like, oh, hey, now we have, like, four.
let's go back and do that secret boss. And it's like, oh, where do our lives go? Whoa.
Yeah.
Big sighs. I was a little bit worried, I think, going into this, thinking that, like, because this, I feel like this game gets, like, the most rap in terms of, like, of a bad reputation.
Yeah, it does.
Out of the three, and going back to it, like, it's totally fine. It's totally competent. Like, I don't think it's necessarily, it may not be as good as the other two. It's probably, two is probably the benchmark, and then maybe this, and then one. Because one's fairly rough around the edges.
It's rough around the edges now.
Because of, obviously, it's the first attempt at one of these kinds of games. But yeah, I think this is a solid middle of the pack entry in the trilogy.
Yeah, I agree with you.
It's totally fine. Like, the characters are fine. They have they're very different compared to each other. So, like, that adds, I think, as well to, like, how you play this game and how you approach it. Because, like, Dixie and Diddy were kind of similar in terms of, like, being smaller, agile characters.
Yeah, I was gonna say they're speed based.
Like, this is more in line with maybe like DKC 1.
Yeah,
but even then it's still different because, like,
Kitty huge,
Kitty's big and, like, just like a is not clearly as agile as Dixie is, where you can float around and he's just like, I'm just gonna beat people up and
I can't even very throw heavy. Him
yes. So, like, I think that helps in terms of, as well, again, another aspect of, hey, this game has a lot of variety to it.
Yeah, like, there were multiple times that we had to switch out because I was like, oh, man, I can't throw you to do this thing. We have to switch.
Yeah.
But that was cool. And also, I think Kitty has little feety pajamas, but his his pajamas are too long, even though he's massive. He's a boy.
He is a big boy indeed. And then you get to hang out with Funky as he builds you boats and stuff.
Yeah, he's your
mechanic.
Yeah, he says some weird things in this too that I was like, all right, I'm about that.
I mean, that's funky. That's Funky Kong for you.
Yeah, we've got Cranky out in the sideshow throwing baseballs.
Mm-hmm.
Which him, that's Swinky. A fun boss, that one with a snowman. Like, that's really creative. That they're like, hey, we have this like target practice mechanic we use for the minigame. Why don't we use that for a boss fight? It's like,
it, especially because like it's completely different from the rest of the game where it's a behind the back, like almost like a shooter.
Yeah.
In a sense.
I'm terrible at it, but it was clever.
So like it's, again, it's another thing that like this is something you're not going to see in the rest of the game in terms of like the levels and stuff. So like very different in that aspect, but it's real cool.
Yeah.
Good use of mode 7. But yeah, like this game's fine.
Yeah, I liked it.
I liked it too. It was a fun time.
I enjoyed playing it. You remembered the like figure eight thing, and you remembered the circle thingy.
Mm-hmm. I told you, I remember some of those secrets. Like it was like one of those things. The figure eight one was one of those things I was like, this feels like a figure eight thing. I don't remember if that's the case or not, but it feels like a figure eight thing. And then it was like, hey, that worked. The circle around the thing is like ingrained into my head because like it's kind of difficult to pull off, especially if you have like one of the faster boats.
Yeah.
Because you just like bonk off stuff and you'll mess it up. So I remember having to do that a lot as a kid. Until I eventually figured out how to do it properly. But yeah.
We have the introduction of the bear pals.
Yeah, the bear pals.
I forget what they're called, but there's a bunch of bears. They're all
the
like...
brothers bear.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
And then King K. Rool shows up twice.
Twice! And I think at one point he like talks about his wife.
Oh yeah, there's weird like Kong dialogue in this game.
Yeah!
Just very weird because it's like, who's talking here? We don't really know.
No, I had no idea.
So yeah, this is the final game they made before Donkey Kong 64, before they introduced the DK rap into the world.
Yeah, which I got to appreciate earlier, but this is definitely the start of the collect-a-thon that like really, really
yeah
took off with 64.
This really was like the introduction of Rare being like, man, collect-a-thons are cool.
Because you've got like the banana birds, you've got the bear coins, you've got the bonus level coins.
DK coins.
And then obviously like you have the regular like bananas and stuff you can get.
And then there's also like the like item exchange stuff that they have throughout the game with the
right,
bears.
Right.
So there's a lot of, like, you can see kind of, like, the genesis of them being like, what if we make a game, a 3D game, where you do a lot of collecting?
And then I tried to play Donkey Kong 64 recently, and the game crashed, and you're like, this is a blessing.
Yeah. DK 64 is, I have not played it, I've seen it played, and it just looks like a mess. And it's like, it seems amazing that, like, they would go from DK 64 to Banjo. And Banjo is a very competent video game.
Banjo is a great video game.
And DK64 just seems like a mess.
I personally really liked it as a kid, but I liked Banjo better.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Banjo is a much tighter video game.
And also, there's just versions of Banjo that are just way better than what you would have been able to play on the N64 available now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, those XBLA versions are just really good.
Yes. And they
solve a lot of the technical problems.
Exactly.
Of that game.
Exactly. So if they did that with DK64 or something, I would probably play it, but I don't think it's
going to Well, that's happen. Never going to happen, so.
Nope. Rip.
So that, yeah, you'll never be able to do that.
No.
But yeah, DKC3, it's a fun game.
It's a fun game. We got to save some DK. I really need some lore. Like, I need to understand what's going on with these Kong people and their families and all this, because I do not understand this family tree.
I don't think they understand the family tree either.
Like I said in the last podcast when we talked about DKC, I would much rather have a Kong family tree given to me than a Zelda timeline.
Yeah.
They gave me the wrong information. Thanks, Nintendo.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Go real deep into the Kong Wars and stuff.
I need to know, man. Give me like a Donkey Kong lore book. I'd read that. I'm serious, though. I would read it.
It would be very wild, I would assume.
I'd be about that.
well,
now let's talk about some like magical realism and Southern Gothic.
Yes. Very just hard pivot into a different direction. Oh, boy. Kentucky Route Zero.
Yes. Your game of the year for 2020.
The 2020 game of the year for moi. A game that came out in full last year in the early parts of 2020. Initially came out in January of 2013. That was when Act 1 came out. It's a long time between the first act coming out and then the game finally being complete, essentially.
You realize 2013 is when I started my PhD?
2013 is when I started college again.
Wow. Our lives have changed a lot since then.
Yeah. It was crowdfunded on Kickstarter in 2011. Way before the idea of kickstarting video games was a thing.
It was really popular, yeah.
It was really a thing. Like, I think the budget on this game was like only like a couple $1,000s.
Does it say in the development section? No, it does not.
It does not. I remember seeing it at some point, though. But it was like very, very low compared to like what...
Double Fine.
Broken Age?
Yeah. Is that what it's called?
It's something like that.
I think you're right.
But like that game and then all of the other games that would come after it that would become like... It would just be like, here's another Kickstarter game that just went... Made a $1 billion on Kickstarter. Not a billion,
a
obviously.
Butt ton.
But a buttload of money. A whole bunch. But yeah, like it's a game that's been out there for years at this point. Like people have been playing this and talking it up because like people play it and are like, oh my god, this is something very interesting. This seems like it's something special. And I think a lot of people have like heard that over the years and have been just been kind of like waiting around for it to finish finally before really diving into it. And that was one of the reasons why I had kind of held off on it. Like, I technically own a PC copy of this game.
Oh, wow.
That I just had never played because I was waiting for the full thing to come out.
I don't blame you. I mean, especially after me playing the full thing at once, like, it would have been hard to remember what happened with the gaps between release.
Yeah. Like, it's hard for, like, episodic games in general, even, like, when they have, like, a year for their full release.
Yeah.
To remember, like, oh, what happened in the last thing? Like, having to go years between acts would be just very difficult, I would assume. Like, the people who pulled through and did all that is just, they are troopers, per se. Before we dive into the game as a whole.
Yeah.
2 weeks ago, you heard my thoughts about this game.
Yes.
I want to hear your thoughts about this game.
You don't want to talk about it and then hear my thoughts?
I want to hear your thoughts first.
Okay. I wasn't prepared for this. Hold on. I gotta figure out how I'm gonna word this. I did really, really enjoy this game. I am a big, big fan of Southern Gothic literature, and this one, like, really nails that in. And magical realism is also a thing, which you know both of those things about me. Not everybody does know that, but those are like two of my ultimate jam genres, and this hit the notes of both of those just repeatedly. It's also got some very interesting notes about like loss and what you're supposed to be, that I find very interesting and also like hard to play through. There are also some very, very creative things that this game does that I appreciate quite a bit, like the game within a game Xanadu.
Yes, I forgot to mention that when we were talking about it for game of the year, but like I love that part. I was like, oh, this is amazing.
It was so cool. And I was like, oh man, it's done on a PDP-1, which is what Space War was done on. So I was like losing my because I was so excited that like I knew the hardware that it was built on. And like I know the mechanics that would have gone behind that vaguely. I don't know exactly, but I know generally how it would work. So to see the setup on there, I was like, that's really cool. But the actual segment itself was also fascinating. And the way that it's tied in narratively is just genius.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I really have a whole lot of like downsides on this. It's wild to me how it changes, though.
In what way?
Like, which this makes sense because of the time gap. Like, the very first segment of the game versus, like, Act 5.
Oh, yeah.
They
totally
act like completely different types of games.
Which I think it helps it because, like, you can see the evolution of how this game just changes, like, design-wise over the years where, like, they're able to, like, add more aspects to it because, you know, they probably made more money on it and everything that they can funnel into the game and everything, like, and it just like changes how you approach the game and everything, and it's very intriguing how like you said, Act 1 like looks a certain way, like it looks kind of like a point and click adventure game, while Act 5 is like almost like more in line with like a modern adventure game.
Yeah, and I think one thing that really works with that is that you go into Act 1, you're like, all right, this is pretty normal. Like, I'm just going down I-65 in Kentucky. I'm going to go stop at this gas station. I'm going to talk to these people. Oh, I need to stop by a TV repair shop. Like, those all seem very normal until they don't. And then, like, you keep getting more and more wild as you continue into this whole idea of like, magical realism. So it's kind of like a rabbit hole of sense of like, oh, everything's normal. Oh, God, things are not normal. And they just continue to get not normal. It also, I agree with you, has some fantastic critiques on like capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, like workers' rights and unions and, you know, their lives.
Yeah.
There's some really, really good stuff about that, which like, heck yes, I'm about that life.
Which you would have been able to kind of maybe pick up on that more early on than I would have,
mm-hmm.
because I told you how like vehemently this is an anti-capitalistic game.
Yeah.
Where like, for me, it took a while for me to kind of like start to think like, oh, this is really what they're going for with this. Whereas mm-hmm. like you knowing that going in, you can like see from the beginning where it's just like, oh mm-hmm. yeah, this is definitely this. You probably had, again, like a better understanding considering what I told you about this game a couple mm-hmm. weeks ago. But did this game click for you right away, or did it take a good while for it to finally be like, oh, this is really what's going on in this story?
It took a bit for it to click.
Yeah.
Because at first I was playing through it, I'm like, all right, this is nice, but like I'm not getting what he was saying about it yet.
Yeah.
Like... In the beginning of Act 1, I'm like, I don't see how this is a game of the year. And
completely fair.
Then as you continue on, I'm like, okay, now I'm getting it.
Yeah.
And I mean, the two of us are also literary dorks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, that's just a fact. So I think that was a part of why, like, narratively it was interesting to us.
Yeah.
They're pulling in a lot of different literary tricks, but also like straight up quotes from literature. They're using like ideas that are in certain like poems and other writings. Like it's really, really clever, and it's not exact, but like the first act of this reminds me a lot of like rural Tennessee, which makes sense because this is kind of rural Kentucky, which
And again, it reminds me a lot of like rural Indiana.
Yeah.
Which it's basically the rural Midwest. Like a lot of that, it just kind of blends together. But there's definitely this feeling of like, if you go out into the rural parts of the Midwest, there's always like these stories of like, there's something weird out there. There's something strange out there that's just waiting to be found.
Mm-hmm. There's that. And there's also just like, you know, everybody kind of knows about each other and knows mm-hmm. like, hey, you know, if you the fact that you get directions of like, oh, hey, you know, go down this road a little bit, take a left at the tree that's burning all the time. I was like, yeah, it sounds about right. Like,
mm-hmm.
I've told you the story about my grandma in the black church.
Yeah.
But like, that's how people I knew when I was growing up gave directions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like, that's very different than like how you or I would give directions at this point.
Right.
So I thought that that was like a nice little touch there that that shows like where what you're dealing with here. I also enjoyed the fact that it had like the oh shoot, what are they called in like Greek plays? I don't remember. Anyway, that like in certain scenes you would have the band playing in front.
Yes, hang on. I know I just saw the word that was used for those. This says it's that they act like a Greek chorus.
Okay. I was thinking muses, but I don't think that's right.
But regardless.
I mean, it basically, like, if you've watched Hercules, it's the muses in Hercules, how they're always making commentary, but it's usually in some form of song.
Yes.
Like, that's what's happening here. And I thought that that was really clever because it also happened at moments that I wasn't expecting it. I was like, oh, hey, there's the band. What up, band? And the interludes were fun because they would give little hints as to what was going on.
They do a good job of kind of being like, here's kind of where the setup for the next act is going to be, and also like, here are characters we are going to introduce for the next act. So you kind of get it like an understanding of like who's this character and what they're going to do, or like who they're going to be when you meet them eventually in the next act. And just some of them are just like real just intriguing in general. Like the interlude from that you get from Act 4 to Act 5 really kind of like paints a picture of what the gameplay is going to be like for Act 5 and how just different it's going to be, because the gameplay and the interlude there is very different from the rest of the game as well. They're so just like smartly done.
I think like in terms of what did I think about this, I think the best description I could give you at this point is that if I had played this last year, it would have made my game of the year list.
Where do you think it would have landed?
I don't remember my game of the year list anymore. It's been so long.
Trails of Cold Steel 4, number 1.
Yes, I know that.
Xenoblade Chronicles, number 2?
Yes. I'm pulling it up.
Please. Hyrule Warriors is on there somehow. Still baffling to me.
It probably would have made 3.
Hmm.
Because Trails of Cold Steel 4 and Xenoblade would be really hard for me to beat. But I think that Magical Realism can top Bone and for Jesus.
Yeah, true. True. Well, that out of the way, let's talk about the story of this, which if you were, I guess there are spoilers. Because we're going to dive real deep into this. I'm going to use the Kentucky Route Zero Wikia because it has more expanded upon descriptions of what happens in each act and everything, so we can kind of dive further into this stuff.
You play as Conway.
You do play as Conway. Like the gist of this game essentially is you're Conway.
You start as Conway.
You're making a delivery. It is basically your last delivery, and you have to find this address that you don't know where it is, and you go try and figure out what's happening and everything, and then it just leads you on to this wild adventure.
Mm-hmm. It's an antique company specifically.
Yes. Let's dive in here. Act 1 begins with Conway pulling up to Equus Oils. He meets Joseph, the owner, who sits outside in a Queen Anne armchair. Joseph gives Conway's hound some jerky, and the player chooses the dog's name. What did you choose as the dog's name?
I went with a girl lamb. I don't remember what it was.
You should have went with Blue.
What were the options?
I don't remember. I named the dog Blue. It's like, that's a cool name.
Well, now I gotta remember what I named it.
That's a good name for an old dog.
Blue.
Conway tells Joseph that he has delivery for 5 Dogwood Drive, and Joseph explains that he will have to take the 0 to find it. He suggests Conway use the computer to find the address of Weaver Marquez, a friend of his who knows how to get there. Fortunately, the power company has shut off Joseph's power, and Conway must first turn on the generator in the station's basement. Joseph gives him a lantern to light the way.
Blue is the girl dog, so I named it Blue.
There you go. You got the correct name. this is hat. where Yeah, this is where you kind of start to understand, like, this game's weird. When you go downstairs and there's three people playing, like, D&D. And then they never talk to you. Yeah, so you're just like, what is going on?
You're trying to talk to them and they will not respond to you.
In the basement, Conway finds Emily, Ben, and Bob, who sit at a card table, playing a tabletop game and blocking the way of the generator. They ignore him, apparently unable to see or hear him. Overhearing that they've lost a glow-in-the-dark die, Conway manages to find it with the lantern turned off and a passage to the lower left. When he returns, the three players have disappeared. Conway starts up the generator and returns outside. If Conway tells Joseph about the people he saw, Joseph dismisses the idea, but notes that strange things happen in the dark.
Conway uses, are they ghosties?
Yeah. Conway uses the computer and finds directions to the Marquez farmhouse, along with several emails. Like, that first bit right there is kind of, like, emblematic of, like, where it's, like, this feels very Midwestern, where it's just, like, oh, just, you know, there's some weird stuff happens in the dark.
Yeah.
You go to specific places, weird things will happen. As Conway leaves, Joseph mentions that he's put Weaver's old TV in the back of Conway's truck and asks that Conway return it to her. At this point, Conway is free to drive the roads of Kentucky and encounter a variety of hidden locations and characters.
Like, you can go back and talk to a guy who wants you to find a venue for his play.
Yes. Which this says, like, anytime before the last visit to the Marquez farmhouse, Conway may return to Equus Oils. There he meets James Carrington, who is searching for a venue. Conway may infer that he means a venue for a band or for shiftier circumstances. Briefly offended, Carrington explains that he is a playwright and means to debut a play. He explains the sort of mood that he wants to set and asks that Conway keep an eye out for venues for him. Which that leads you to the final interlude, essentially.
Yeah.
When you get to the Marquez farmhouse, Conway pulls up to a dirt road and climbs the hill to the farmhouse where he meets Weaver. You also find, like, on the way, the path there, like, there's, like, gravestones and stuff, and it's like, this is kind of sketch.
Well, I mean, like, a lot of family homes.
True, but also just like, am I gonna go get murdered out here or something?
Come on, they do a better job hiding the bodies than just burying them in plain sight. I mean, actually, that's actually a genius way to hide a body, though, is to have a cemetery and just put the body in the cemetery, because no one's going to look for a new body in the cemetery.
FBI, do not listen to this podcast.
I'm not going to murder anybody. Not my style.
He pulls up to the farmhouse, meets Weaver. She knows that Joseph sent him for directions to the Zero and asks Conway to set up the TV. Once it is set up, the screen shows an image of a cave. Weaver complains that Conway has set it up incorrectly. Conway then zones out for a moment at the barn out back. Although Weaver would rather Conway find her cousin, Shannon Marquez, and fix her TV, she tells him that he can find an on-ramp to the Zero by heading north on the 65 and passing the artificial limb factory. When Conway looks away from the screen, Weaver has vanished. Upon heading back to the truck, Emily, Ben, and Bob can be seen heard playing You've Got to Walk in the foreground. So there's one of your first little musical
bits.
Then you go to the Elkhorn Mine. Conway pulls up to the Elkhorn Mine. Though skeptical that the mine would be an on-ramp, he walks inside. Shannon stands in the entryway to the mine, on the phone with someone about a looming eviction. As she hangs up, Conway approaches. He explains his predicament. Shannon then reveals that she encountered Weaver earlier that evening and that Weaver told Shannon to come to the mine and find something she was looking for. It's also worth mentioning that, like, a lot of, like, the dialogue in this game is basically kind of, like, stuff you can just say.
Yeah,
like, it's a lot of, like, various choices that you get to make, and for the most part, like, it means that, like, you have your own kind of understanding of what who these characters are and how they will react to things, how they will react to specific scenes and other characters and everything, which makes it, I think, this game just really unique in that regard, because a lot of narrative choice games are very binary and rigid, where it's like you have the good choice, the neutral choice, the evil choice, whereas here, like, none of that really matters. It's just you're picking choices for how you would think these characters would react in this situation. And it's not like, oh, well, I'm doing this to fulfill a percentage at the end of this act to see how I did with other players. Like, no, that doesn't exist. It's just this is your choose your own adventure game, essentially.
I had a moment where I went to go look for Shannon at the TV shop. And there's, like, glowing fish tank things. And I was like, oh, I'm going to put my arm in this. And, like, at one point, like, you get shocked and have like a weird vision. I forgot exactly what it was, but it was so bizarre. And then the guy's like, hey, man, there's like an electrical cord in this water. I don't know why you'd stick your arm in it. And he's like, yep, that sounds about right. But like they're all kind of weird. Like one's all goopy and he can't figure out what it is. And I had a fun time sticking my arm in the fish tanks.
Nice. Shannon then reveals that she encountered Weaver earlier that evening and that Weaver told Shannon to come into the mine to find something she was looking for. The two head into the mine and Shannon has Conway make noise into the PA system in order to judge the depth, width, and air quality of the tunnels. During the last test, the reverberation causes the roof of the mine to collapse onto Conway, mangling his leg. Shannon manages to free him and get him onto the old tram system used by miners where the mine was operational. When they drive the tram to the center, Shannon informs Conway that the mine flooded at one point, killing many miners trapped inside. They explore the mine and see apparitions of the dead miners that are in the flickering sparks thrown off the tram wires. How did you have Conway react to his leg getting all busted up?
I think I was just like, oh, it's fine.
Yeah, I think that was also, he would just be old and stubborn and be like, yeah, it's fine.
Yep.
It looks real bad, but like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, it's like bent.
Like, there's definitely a point later where like Shannon's like, do you want to take some drugs for this? And he's like, nope, got to drive.
Yep.
At the end of one mine passageway, they come to a stage which Shannon explains was used by folk song archivists. It feels like that's wrong, but okay.
It's not. That's right. Archivists.
For recording the songs miners would sing. The archivists luckily escaped the flooding. After exploring, they reached the exit. Shannon leaves Conway in order to explore a tunnel they couldn't previously due to the track being broken. In the dark depths, she discovers piles and piles of helmets of the deceased miners. Conway leaves the mine and discovers a small shack outside near his truck. He finds three notebooks which belong to Weaver's parents, who Shannon informs him upon returning from the tunnel were the archivists working with the miners. She insinuates that her parents drowned in the flooding, but doesn't tell Conway about finding the helmets. Like, again, like this, like you said, this first act kind of starts off kind of just like meandering and just like, you know, normal things. And it's like, hey, let's get real dark real quick.
Yep. Yep. Like seeing the little like ghosties in there, I was like, ooh. And then like knowing that people died in there. And like at one point she's talking about the tokens that they could buy, tokens and put like trinkets on the carts. And then like there's the like directional thing is decorated by like a scarecrow and some other things. And I was like, yeah, it sounds about like how it was with sharecroppers, that like you would have currency that is exclusive to like your employment, that like you would have to use, and they're just using it to bring some kind of joy to this joyless existence.
Or the thing I think that like came out this year, not 2020 or 2019, about like Amazon doing kind of the exact same thing. A big proponent of what you might call capitalism.
Yeah. It's like, oh, hey, you know, we're not paying you anything, and this is a very dangerous job, but we gave you this little trinket. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely implied that her parents died. And the archivist and the music thing is actually really cool because during the Great Depression, they actually... And I don't think this is when this was going on, but during the Great Depression, that was a thing that they did, is that in order to, like, archivists and historians and things like that, they would send them out to record, like, folk songs and, like, old slave songs and things like that so that they could be saved. And so, like, there's an actual, like, historic basis for people going to do that.
Interesting. So they go back to the Marquez farmhouse.
Yep.
Shannon repairs a TV. The Marquez barn then just disappears, replaced by the cave previously seen on the screen. The on-ramp to the zero. Conway and Sharon drive into the mouth of the cave. That ends Act 1. With the way the TV edition is set up, they have little interludes that just kind of flow in after you finish an act. The first one is called Limits and Demonstrations, where you're in like this museum set up for one of the characters you meet in Act 2, who is, what's her face? Lula Chamberlain. It's a bunch of like her art stuff that she's like made. And like you, I think we'll walk around with Emily, Ben, and Bob.
Yep.
and they like comment on like the specific pieces and everything, and like talk about like what they think it means and all that sort of stuff. That's about it.
Yep.
Act 2, which was released on May 31st, 2013, so a little bit after Act 1. Lulu Chamberlain receives a rejection letter from the Gaston Trust for Imagined Architecture. If the player met Carrington in Act 1, he will visit Lula and ask her about a previous request he sent in to her. If not, Lula's manager Rick will talk to her about the upcoming office party. Which that was the one I got because I did not talk to Carrington at first.
I talked to Carrington.
So it was like, he just comes up to her like, hey, you going to the office party? Did you get a bad letter, rejection letter? That sucks. It's real awkward. Thoroughly lost on the Zero, Conway and Shannon stop at the Bureau of Reclaimed Spaces for directions. They speak to the receptionist Marianne about finding 5 Dogwood Drive. Unable to assign them any of the proper clerks for the process, she instead sets them up to meet with Lula. After failing to navigate the bureaucratic mess of junior clerks that Rick presents them with,
Conway, so good how they do that.
All right, you gotta go up to this floor. Well, no, I can't do anything for you. Go down to this floor. Well, nope, can't do anything for you. Go up to this floor.
It's so perfect how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is exactly how this kind of thing works.
She tells them that she used to live on a Dogwood Drive, but that it cannot be the same one as there are many streets named Dogwood Drive, and all, except presumably the one they are searching for, had their names changed to avoid computational name collisions. Depending on the player's direction or decisions, Lulu may speculate that her former lover Joseph sent them there to get her attention, or that her former intern Weaver overestimated Lua's capabilities. I think she mentioned Joseph to me.
I don't remember who she mentioned to me.
Lula claims that she can't help, but after some consideration, changes her mind and sends Conway and Shannon to search the Bureau's records to the address of the one remaining Dogwood Drive. After the two come up empty-handed, Lula sends them to the St. Thomas Church. As the Bureau has only recently been moved to its current location, many of its records have not yet been transferred. She also directs Conway to Director Truman to help with his leg. At the storage space, Shannon looks for the records while Conway rests and speaks to the janitor. They talk and or listen to a recorded sermon until Shannon returns. Conway briefly blacks out, at which point Shannon demands he go immediately to Dr. Truman's. The janitor talk was kind of interesting because, like, he's just like, yeah, I just kind of play this recording because that's just what I got to do.
Yep.
And it's like, you can, like, either just talk to the guy or listen to the recording. And, like, I just had Conway kind of, like, I think it kind of, like, meandered between both, where he would talk a little bit and listen and talk a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
This is an interesting way to do that.
Yeah, I talked a lot to the guy.
Yeah. And then he's like, bonk, I'm going to pass out here. Sleepy times. they return to the Bureau only to find that Lula has disappeared in a hurry, but before she left, she processed all the files needed to transfer Conway and Sharon back to the surface roads. The two head out of the Zero to find Dr. Truman, but where his house should be, they find only the Museum of Dwellings. Here they encounter residents of the museum's many dwellings and explore the displayed houses. It's also interesting where, like, when you get on the Zero, it's just a circle.
Yep.
And, like, the directions are, like, if you wanted to go to the Bureau of Reclaimed Spaces, it's, like, get to this one specific spot until you, like, drive around until you find that. Then immediately once you find it, turn counterclockwise and drive around until you'll find the Bureau.
Yeah.
It's a very just bizarre road.
Yeah, the road is very, very weird, and the things that you encounter there are very weird.
Mm-hmm.
Which, speaking of very weird, this museum.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one thing that is kind of neat is that Conway finds a house in the museum. He's like, this is where I grew up. He's like, why is this here?
It's people living in just random houses in a museum.
Yep.
And are very just, like, standoffish about people coming in.
Yep.
Like, are these people, like, going to rob us or something? Or are they just shady? Or what's going on here?
Yeah, I was kind of getting, like, the hill people kind of vibes off of them, that, like, you come onto their territory and they shoot you.
Because, like, it's the way they kind of, like, tell this part of the story is that, like, it's told through, like, people having a conversation with someone else being like, oh, did they come up and talk to you? Mm-hmm. And you're like, yeah, I told them about this, and then they left, and I watched them through the window to see what they were doing. Like, all that sort of stuff. It's very bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
Conway, Shannon, and the dog take a construction lift to the roof where they meet Ezra. The boy explains that he and Julian fly many of the museum's homes out to the forest at night because the forest is easier to sleep in, but Dr. Truman asks not to be brought back. Ezra agrees to bring Conway and company to the doctor and calls Julian, who snatches them off the roof and flies them to the forest. Which are like, oh, Julian, that's probably some random person, right? No, it's just a giant bird.
Giant bird. And I was like, what is happening?
Like, that's the moment where if you have not figured out this game is just going places, like, that's the big punch in the face where it's like, okay, here you go.
We're flying now.
After a short but grueling hike, the group finds Dr. Truman. There's also a point where you're walking through the forest and you get another musical interlude.
Yep.
While Ezra and Shannon watch TV, the doctor inspects Conway's leg and gives him a dose of Neuropinol TM. He goes through like this big long speech about it. He's like, yeah, I know all about this because I went to this one seminar about it and all this sort of stuff. So here's all the stuff about it and everything. Conway falls deep into a nebulous drug-induced sleep. Drugs. Following that is the second interlude called The Entertainment.
Do, 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 do. Wait, that's The Entertainer. Anyway, continue.
So this is like the big play.
Ah.
Scene where they're in a bar and you're just watching a play go on. Like there's an audience behind you. You see like the crew around you and you see like all a bunch of like different stuff and everything. It's real wild. This has some background information about it.
Okay.
The show is comprised of two plays by Lem Doolittle, A Reckoning and A Barfly. Joseph Wheatree has adapted the plays for simultaneous performance and has been renamed The Entertainment. The production took place November 16th, 1973 by the Buffalo Street Student Theater. Lula Chamberlain was the set designer for the performance. She complains in her production notes that Doolittle described very little apart from dialogue and that putting together the set was difficult. The script includes 15 sound cues, most of which consist of eerie atmospheric drones. The love song in the game is by Ben Babbitt. It is an adaptation of the original Love Letter Full of Promises by Juanita Rogers. And then it gives the cast of like who's who. It's just like here's the characters that show up. And then it gives you a scene-by-scene breakdown of what happens in this play, which will basically some stuff of this will kind of like pop up later on in the forthcoming acts. The show opens on the inside of the Lower Depths, a bar in Kentucky. It's morning and Harry stands behind the bar while Evelyn sits on a stool in front of it. The barfly slumps drunkenly over a table. They talk about the hot weather. Evelyn mentions her husband Ted, who is currently in Texas, and wonders if he'll be unfaithful to her. Harry comforts her. He mentions that he's now only serving Hard Times whiskey, and Evelyn asks if he's ever seen one of the boys from Hard Times. She's heard they're strange. When she asks about all the bread Harry has, Harry explains it's for sandwiches due to Rain's Law. Rain's Law.
I don't either.
It is the New York State Liquor Tax Law of 1896.
Ah. So it would be like you have to have food in order to have a liquor license?
It increased the cost of liquor licenses, raised the drinking age from 16 to 18, and prohibited the sale of alcoholic beverages on Sundays except in hotels as well as lodging houses with at least 10 rooms that serve drinks with complimentary meals. Hmm. So there you go. He considers getting a hostess for the bar and explains that he saw one when he was on vacation at the beach in New Orleans. The two of them consider the barfly slumped over his table, and Evelyn wonders if Ted is in a similar state in Texas and explains that he is selling hammers. She asks Harry what the entertainment that night will be, and he tells her that it will be Junebug. Scene 2. It is now afternoon, but nothing else has changed. Harry changes the channel on the TV, and Evelyn tells him to switch it back to the documentary on dinosaurs. She complains that there were no dinosaurs in Noah's Ark. They talk about church, and Harry says he hasn't been to one since he used to go with a woman named Bess. They remark on how she was a good Christian woman. Evelyn asks about Harry's vacation, and he says it was 7 days poolside. She confronts his contradiction, and Harry says he can't remember if he was at the beach or a pool. Pearl enters and asks whether her parents are there, as she needs to talk to them. They aren't there, so Evelyn offers a drink and tells Pearl that they're only serving Hard Times. Pearl is uncomfortable about the whiskey and the rumors surrounding it. They talk about travel, and Evelyn begins mocking Ted and his business selling hammers, imagining that he'll get lonely on the road and be unfaithful. Evelyn brings up Harry's lapse in memory about his vacation, and he grows increasingly uncomfortable. The women tell him he looks stressed. They question whether he really went on vacation at all, and Harry is irritated. Pearl starts talking about how she is going to cut off her parents' tab at the bar because she's tired of paying, and Harry is concerned about the debt, saying, "You never know when they'll be reckoned and called in." They discuss different kinds of debts and loans. Harry gives Pearl a free drink, warns her to pay her tab, and she leaves. Scene 3. Evening in the bar, now Rosa and Lawrence, Pearl's parents, sit at a table. Rosa talks about her boss telling her she is a management material, and they talk excitedly about a possible promotion. Harry tells them to pay their bill, and they try to shake him off the subject by asking about gators on his New Orleans vacation. To his chagrin, Evelyn comments sarcastically on the big sandy swamp with a pool and a hostess. They get ready for the entertainment, and Harry says there will be a reckoning on all the drinks he's giving out. Lawrence says he's heard about a secret ingredient in hard times. Rosa thinks it's something about the wood they age it in. Rosa and Lawrence continue to drink and assume Pearl will pay the bill, though Harry suggests otherwise. Junebug is late. Harry hopes she shows up soon. And then finally, scene 4. It is now late at night. The bargoers are still there, and Pearl has returned to speak with her parents. A love song is playing. Evelyn is drunk and complains angrily to Pearl that she is suspicious of Ted cheating on her. Pearl confronts her but gripes about how tired she is of paying for her parents. Upset, Lawrence tries to tell Pearl about the possible raise Rosa is getting. After Pearl repeatedly refuses to pay for her parents' drinks, Rosa admits that her manager only said maybe eventually. It is unlikely she will get a promotion at all. Lawrence is stunned. Evelyn refuses to go home, saying she will wait for Junebug to arrive, but the performer is very late, and Harry insists she isn't coming. Harry tells Evelyn to settle up, but Pearl offers to buy her a drink instead. Harry cracks and admits that he didn't go on vacation. He tells him there will be a reckoning. Rosa asks what he means. Harry admits that he has no money left. He gave away too many drinks and had to make a deal to stock whiskey. Pearl is concerned about this and asks what kind of deal, but Harry insists that she leave, saying she doesn't deserve this. Pearl leaves. Evelyn reveals that she only wishes that Ted would cheat on her as she doesn't want to be the at fault for not loving him. Rosa is depressed that she's nowhere near a promotion after 11 years of working in the supermarket. Harry tells everyone to leave, but they insist to stay and see the entertainment. Harry says that all they want is debt. They feed on it. They put it in the whiskey. Evelyn is startled sober and demands to know what he means. Harry says that the boy from Hard Times is coming and there will be a reckoning. Lawrence says the debt they have isn't to the distillery, but Harry reveals, it is now. I traded it. I sold it. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. A disconcerting hum begins and a glowing skeleton, likely one of the boys from Hard Times, appears. Curtain.
There's also a part in this where one of the characters mentions that, like, they're talking about debt, and she says that she has that position because people look like her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was like, oh, wow, I know where you're going with this.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was definitely one of those, like, oh, boy.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Then we go into Act 3, which was released in May of 2014.
Junebug!
Get to meet some good characters.
Yeah.
Conway sits at breakfast with Lizette on the morning before he left with the delivery to Dogwood Drive. They talk about her dead son, Charlie, and she displays obvious memory trouble. A woman, Cora, is coming to take her away, most likely to an assisted living center. The dream slowly vanishes, and Conway then awakens back at Dr. Truman's. Truman has fixed Conway's leg, which appears to have been replaced entirely by a ghostly skeletal leg, like those had by the skeleton Hard Times workers. Only Conway is able to see the phantom leg, commenting on it briefly. Truman tells Conway he couldn't have been dreaming due to the use of Neuropnol, TM. He then explains future leg care Neuropnol side effects, telling Conway he will never be fully recovered. Because he's in medical debt.
Yep. Yep.
Conway, Shannon, and Ezra are back at the Museum of Dwellings. Shannon tells Conway about her past drug problems with Weaver's ADD medication. Emily, Ben, and Bob of Lemons and Demonstration stand outside the museum, debating whether to enter. Conway tells them not to, but they don't appear to hear him, like in Act 1, and continue arguing. Ezra runs to the edge of the rain-filled parking lot and stands with Flora, watching her paper boat flow away. Conway and Sharon, now having the files for Lula, decide to head back to Equus Oils for directions to the Zero from Joseph, as the cave entrance from Act 1 located in the backyard of the Marquez farmhouse has vanished. So they go on a little bit of a drive, and then eventually the truck is like, blah, blah, blah.
I'm old.
I'm an old truck. Conway's truck stalls out next to a tree, and Shannon calls a tow truck company, but doesn't get help. Junebug and Johnny drive by on a motorcycle, on the way to perform at the Lower Death's Bar. Although they are late already, they stop to help in hopes of gaining an audience at their performance, excuse me. Which is interesting, because, like, they just, like, blow by them, and Conway and Chandler's like, huh. Those are some people.
They're going fast.
And then, it's like, it cuts back to Junebug and Johnny. They're like, should we go help them? And like you have to decide, like, do we go help them or do we just keep driving?
I went to help them.
Yes. Players can stop and talk with Joseph at Equus Oils, mentioning the encounter with Lula. If you wanted to do that. I didn't do that either. Then you go to the bar. At the bar, Junebug and Johnny perform their song Too Late to Love You. Harry, the bartender, then gives them directions to the Zero.
That scene is so cool. Like, the roof comes off and, mm-hmm. like, she transforms and it's really beautiful.
It's really...
Also, you get to choose the lyrics for the song.
Yes, which is really interesting.
That's really fun.
Again, like, this, the way this game does, like, just narrative choice is just unlike anything I've played.
Yeah, because, I mean, like, that doesn't affect anything. But, like, it's fun that you get to choose how this song is going to play out.
Mm-hmm. It gives you more player agency than a lot of other games out there.
Yeah.
So you go back on the Zero, and then you go and meet Donald and his assistants, who reside within the mountain working on a project known as Xanadu.
Xanadu!
Xanadu, named for the poem Kubla Khan by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. My guy. Is a computer and gaming program that has been infused with the black mold of the cave. The mold seems to have given life to the system, changing it in unpredictable ways. When the group go to use the computer, they realize that it can't function in its current state and ask Donald what they can do. He explains that throughout the project, they have been interrupted by the strangers in the cave. They should know how to fix the computer, but there is a looming sense of foreboding about them. The group exit the cave by Donald's directions and come out in a graveyard. Shannon and Conway leave Junebug and Ezra for a moment to gather info. They return rather disturbed, and the group returns to repair the computer. Xanadu is then started up and played as a text adventure game starring Donald, Joseph, and Lula. The story documents their cave project and relationships and tells of how Donald ended up working the project alone in the cave with hired assistants from the college they used to attend. After that, Lula arrives with information for Donald to process and returns to the Bureau. It isn't a heartwarming reunion. Once at the Bureau, Shannon receives the next set of directions to follow from Lula, and Junebug inquires about what happened at the graveyard. Flashback to the graveyard where Conway and Shannon enter a church with a metal floor and rickety moonshine still in the corner. Nothing else. No strangers. They sit on a pew and Shannon talks to Conway about what happened back in the mines. Before she entered the mines herself, Weaver, previously thought to be deceased, appeared to her on a TV in her shop, telling her via closed captions to go to the mine. Suddenly, the pew lowers into a vast open area, the Hard Times Whiskey Distillery. Shannon and Conway are greeted by a glowing skeleton named Doolittle, one of the strangers, quote-unquote. Mm-hmm. He assumes they have come in search of work. Most, if not all, current employees are there to work off a debt. There are some new recruits, human in form, learning the formula for managing the numbers involved in financial disarray taught to the strangers by Weaver when she contacted them while working with Donald on the Xanadu project. The player can use Shannon's CRT to see some of the strangers better and get Doolittle to comment on their work and debt troubles. Doolittle takes him on a grand tour of the distillery and ends up in the shipment area, where he plans to put Conway to work in place of Miguel, who is the driver of the truck in the accident witnessed in Act 1. The artificial lighting dims, and Doolittle slows his gait. As Conway investigates the features of the delivery truck, he recalls some somber moments of his past. Before signing on as a new truck driver, Conway and Doolittle are interrupted by Shannon, who says they just want to know how to repair Xanadu. Doolittle informs him that the black mold is attracted to the evaporated alcohol, the angel share, and they'd routinely scrape the mold to squeeze out every last drop back into their supply. This is no longer necessary thanks to Weaver's formula. He tells them how to get the computer up and running properly. Doolittle then congratulates Conway as a new member of the distillery team and offers him a customary start of the shift drink. Venom memore mors, wine is the death of memory. The cursor moves against the player's will to drink as the background fades to black. Shannon says Conway will not be working for them as they have somewhere to be. Doolittle disgruntlingly charges Conway an undisclosed amount of money for that expensive drink and says he will have to pay it off by working starting tomorrow. End of the flashback. Conway still has a delivery to make, so the group boards the ferry to the next destination. You learn about, like, why the computer is the way it is in that flashback, but mm-hmm. when you get back to the computer after the trip there, where you don't see the flashback, there's like options like, how do you fix this computer? And I was like, I guess scrape black mold off it. That seems like a reasonable thing. And then I was like, oh, that's the right answer. Good job.
The Xanadu scene is amazing. It's super, super cool.
It's really good.
There was something I was going to mention about the whole Oh, I was going to say that it's worth mentioning that Conway is a recovering alcoholic.
Yes, that's, I think, one of the... That shows up in those, like, flashbacks he's getting in when he's examining the truck, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You see, like, all these, like, stuff about his, like, college days and everything, and, like, you learn exactly that, like, you know, he's a recovering alcoholic and everything, and then, like, once he takes that drink in the distillery, like, everything kind of spirals out of control after that.
Yep.
I think as well, at this point, another one of his limbs has turned glowy skeleton.
His arm. Literally, yeah. An arm and a leg.
An arm and a leg. Not being real subtle about that.
Nope. But his arm has also turned into a skeletal arm. So, yep, an arm and a leg.
An arm and a leg.
How about that?
Up next is the interlude here and there along the Echo, which is just, you get to be on a phone.
You get to call a phone. I was playing this while I was at my house, and my brother was just amazed by this. Which one thing that I will say is that the audio on this, like, the music's great, but also just like the audio design of this game is amazing.
Yeah.
And so, like, this entire segment was super fun, but the way that they actually pulled off the, like, phone noises, and it was just so, so good. But you get to learn about the river. Find out what's going on in terms of wildlife and things to see and mysteries.
So once again, it's Emily, Ben, and Bob. They're just calling this telephone number, which is a guide from the Bureau of Secret Tourism. Provides some information about the Echo River. The guide offers information about a number of locations found in Act 4, including the Rum Colony, the Iron Pariah, the Silo of Late Reflections, Sam and Ida's, and the Mucky Mammoth. The guide also describes a town inhabited by horses that walk the streets and that has its own roads, but no roads lead to or from the town. Mm-hmm. A hint to Act 5. Mm-hmm. By dialing the extension 7360 at the beginning of the game, the player is prompted to tell the Bureau why they can't sleep. In Act 4, Will checks his answering machine and listens to messages that seem to be responses to this question. If the player hangs up the phone and waits, eventually they will receive a series of strange phone calls, some of which are merely strings of numbers, and one of which appears to be Morse code. That's cool.
I didn't know that.
I didn't either. Some fans have attempted to crack the codes transmitted through the mysterious phone calls. Fans have suggested that the Morse code message in the fourth phone call, in fact, translates to a conversation between an operator and a caller that references Dogwood Drive, which may be a road in the previously referenced town, while the number sequence in the second phone call seems to translate to an enigmatic poem.
Oh.
Which I can click to, and maybe we can read this.
Ooh. Poetry?
This is the decoded, apparently, thing. By night we suffer, wondering. Night frees the imprisoned spirits, and his cage-abandoned Cerberus himself strays. At dawn, the law demands return to the pools of Bleth. We are borne across, and the ferryman counts the load he's carried.
Hmm.
So, interesting.
Yeah.
I like how this, like, it just goes, it just, this the whole thing goes into, like, this whole Steam page, it just goes into, like, here's about number stations. And I'm like, yes. Good. But yeah, that's eventually that interlude. It's just, you get to be on a phone. It's cool.
Old phone.
And then we get to Act 4. Act 4, probably the longest act, I would say, in the game.
Yeah, it was pretty long.
This came out in July 2016.
Okay.
Act 4 opens to the scene of Will, the handyman of the Mucky Mammoth Ferry, struggling with a manual for mechanical mammoth repair. He has a brief conversation with Junebug about the river. He tells Shannon that he was a teacher at the university, but has been demoted to odd jobs and ended up helping out his friend and captain of the ferry, Kate. Kate tells Sharon that they have some weird tapes in the VCR room of a woman talking, but you can't hear her. There is a strange hum. Johnny and Junebug hang out inside with fellow musician and traveler from Lithuania, Clara. Johnny sends Ezra out with his tape recorder to collect all kinds of sounds to use for their musical performance. Conway grabs a beer from the fridge with his new skeletal right arm after being sober for 15 months. He has a conversation with Shannon about his drinking. The player chooses as Ezra to either stay on the boat stay on the boat at the gas station or go with Johnny and Junebug. I believe I went to the gas station with them.
Yeah, I went to the gas station.
At the gas station... Kate says they stop at the floating gas station every night, but it drifts about on the Echo, so it isn't always in the same spot. She talks to Junebug about the roaming storm upstairs and possible flooding and damages. upstairs being, I think, the, like, reality, not the zero. She looks forward to the mushrooms that it'll bring and says her dog Valkyrie helps find them. Junebug talks to the gas station attendant and he tells her he has some cool crystals for sale and goes on to tell her he used to be a wealthy and living in Cleveland, Ohio. Until he ran out of money and took up his current job. Kate never remembers him, but he says it's okay. Junebug considers why Johnny may be feeling preoccupied. Maybe he wants Ezra to join them permanently. She wishes he would confide in her more. She's greeted by a man, Norm, who mistakes her for a woman named Loretta, who he met online and had planned to meet at the gas station. He met his now ex-wife, Greta, while he was working in textiles, but she left him for unknown reasons. He has two adult children and is retired. He asks Junebug for help with his online dating profile. Johnny talks to a man named Al. Not you.
Not me.
He tells a story of how he was lost adrift on the Echo without a lantern for a very long time and almost starved to death. But on the last apple he had, there was a newborn insect that turned out to be a lightning bug, and he survived by his tiny flight. Glory, it is good to be among friends. That's what the dude says.
Mm-hmm.
If the player chooses to stay on board, Ezra makes some observations from the captain's chair, and Kate talks to him about the floating gas station, what the dials and gauges on the dashboard mean, and her homebrewed kombucha. She relies heavily on sight and light since compasses don't work well in the Echo. She's concerned about the placement of one of her landmarks, which seems to be in the wrong place, so she sends Ezra to the map room to talk to Will about it. Ezra records some more sounds. Conway tells him maps are probably needed for boats, but he doesn't use them, just landmarks and directions. Shannon tries out Clara's theremin. Will asks Ezra for more info to update the map for accuracy since things often end up shifting on the river. Will offers a selection of old maps to Ezra to choose from if he's interested. As the boat continues on its journey, Will recounts what most likely happened at the gas station. The musicians probably talked to the attendant for a while and looked for food that wasn't found in nature.
I just had a realization.
What's up?
Junebug and Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
They're named after mm-hmm. Johnny Cash and June.
Mm-hmm.
It just clicked with me.
Traveling musicians. Also, they're like androids.
Yeah, they're androids.
Which has not brought up, but yeah, that's what they are.
Yeah, because at one point she's like, yeah, we were like soulless and all gray, and then we decided that we weren't into that after they heard the music from the archivists.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, we don't like this. We're going to go be robot musicians.
Yep.
Which is cool.
Next, the player chooses Shannon to stay aboard and repair the VCR or go to the Rum Colony Bar.
I went to the VCR.
I also went to the VCR, so we missed this other part entirely.
Yep.
At the Rum Colony, Junebug tells Shannon their musician friend Cyrano, Wizard of the Lapsteel Guitar, is playing at the bar tonight. She is late to meeting a woman for bike parts. Rick from the Bureau is relaxing on the shore with a drink. Or rather, he's trying to relax. He says Lula broke off from the group to do some packing. Bohm, Medstain, and Lewis drink and chat nearby. They are celebrating a big milestone, but nobody knows what it is. Marianne says the hard time shipment never arrived for their celebration. It was the crash site in Act 1. Conway has a drink and talks about how his past is taking over and surrounding him. He doesn't belong in the here and now. A man named Sonny complains to Shannon about environmental threats and how woeful it all is. Next to him is Dawn, his wife, who says he worries too much and not to listen to him. Warning! It is possible to completely miss this next part as the player does not talk to Patch at the bar when Johnny and Junebug are sitting next to him and instead talks to him a second time at the dock. Patch, the bartender, talks to Junebug for a bit. She missed the lady she was supposed to meet up with for bike parts. Patch offers a seemingly endless list of drinks, but they decline. Johnny talks to Cyrano, who is struggling for cash but doesn't want his audience to know it. Johnny sets out to collect tips while Cyrano plays. As they set up to leave, Conway is sitting at his table talking with a few skeletal figures seen with the flashlight.
Hmm.
That makes what's going to happen later on a little bit more make sense.
Yep.
And not as shocking.
Right.
If the player chooses to stay on board, Shannon watches various tapes on the TV, like ones about birds, a funeral, weather, art. One tape is of Will, younger, taking calls about supernatural stories just to listen. The tape marked ... has Weaver on it. She is in a dingy room with lockers and desks. The captions read, "Mail, school, and these magnificent tragic horses. Go underground, as deep as you can go. The air is cool and the earth is damp, and when you close your eyes, you are surrounded by the dead. Remember where that is? You'll find your way from there. I think this place is what you're looking for. Some of it will wash away soon, but I think you'll be happy here, even without the mail, school, and it repeats." Will and Kate discuss what the Mammoth song was like. There is a music box hidden inside the Mammoth they used to play, but not for years. Kate says that the tapes are all weird since the VCR will randomly record over tapes, and the only station they ever get is WEVP. Kate says Shannon should talk to Dashiell at the telephone exchange. He used to volunteer at WEVP, and they might have a lot in common. As the boat takes off, Will recounts hearing what happened at the bar, either about Conway's drinking, the dark corners of the beach, or Junebug's feeling at ease about missing her appointment. He says Patch is the general manager and creative director, but not the owner. He's run the bar for 7 years, but a dead man named Vernon owns it. The power company would be the owners, but no one has ever identified the body. Patch makes a good Mai Tai. Then you can choose a scene with the dogs below deck or with the humans. I think this is like... Yeah, you go to the phone.
Yeah. I did that. The little water telephone booth.
Same. When you go to the phone, the group waits in line at a phone. Ezra plans to make a phone call, and Conway drops into the water and swims back to shore to drink more. Will is first to the phone. He listens to his messages and real audio recordings as the screen splits and shows the player the waiting area table from the bureau. The first is a recording of a man describing going to see a new residence. The second is about bathing in the sink. The third, about a woman parallel parking and how it smells in the old car. The fourth is a person going to school. The fifth, a person who can't sleep. The sixth, what? The seventh, a man about to go overseas. Another man who can't sleep. A guy who held a snake. A yellow flash car with a turkey and tin on it. The messages continue to be strange snips of conversations and parts of stories. Will says every message is important. Kate is up next. Screen splits to show the home of Summer, a pregnant client of Kate's. Summer can't get comfortable to sleep, so she is up watching TV. Kate suggests a natural remedy of her for her pains. Kate tells the others that she's a birth doula and treats things with her experience rather than how a nurse treats a situation like an illness to be cured.
I love that.
Clara calls her older sister Nadia in Lithuania, and the screen splits to a higher floor of a cramped, noisy apartment complex. Uncle Andreas has been moved to hospice care and is not accepting visitors. Nadia suggests Clara come home and try to see him, but there isn't enough time. Brandon, the janitor from the self-storage, asks if the group will be going by the bureau since his mother didn't pick him up as she usually does. He was too busy playing a game and didn't call in time. The phone rings and Shannon answers. The screen splits to show Carrington at a payphone under a Hard Times neon light. He says no one is there yet, but he really needs help with an aspect of his performance. If he chooses the mine, he'll need moonlight, for example. He thinks Shannon and the boat sets off. If the player chooses to stay on board, the two dogs relax and do nothing. The boat moves on.
Nice.
Will recollects what they did during that time. He listened to his phone messages. Kate, who is a birth doula, checked in on a client, and Clara talked to her sister about a family health issue. Next, the player chooses between a card game with Ezra or a stop at the Radvinsky Center for Cash.
I went to the Radvinsky Center.
Oh, I did the card game.
Ooh.
Different. The scene is viewed from the security camera, and Mimi and Jen are having a conversation off screen. They are viewing the tape without knowing the date on it, but it seems to be a good bit in the past. They interpret what they see. They mention their boss, Daryl, frequently. Sharon sits down to fill out a questionnaire for Cash. Mimi recognizes the name Marquez and mentions WEVP-TV, a community TV station owned by the Consolidated Power Company. She knew Weaver worked there and left on strange terms, in that she just stopped showing up. She was an archivist. They determined Shannon to be average and normal. Shannon feeds Coconut to the facility cat.
Yeah.
Mimi recognizes Will from her university days. She said during that time her boyfriend died suddenly by falling off a roof. It was Charlie, Lizette's son. A few months after Weaver's departure, weird things started happening. There would be strange signal jamming interference when shows were broadcast, and a scene of Weaver in the studio just looking into the camera accompanied by a sinister hum and creepy captions. Captions were always the same, but Mimi can't recall what they were. The captions were in a different font than usual, and the broadcast seemed urgent. This went on for years. The last one occurred right before the flood. Shannon makes a phone call, and a strange man answers. He's an orthopedic physical therapist. They have a brief chat about getting to know how someone is by their voices. Conway is seen outside with several skeletal figures. Coconut, the cat, leaves with the group.
Yep.
If the player chooses to stay on board, Ezra teaches a card game to Will, Kate, and Clara while they listen to a musical tape by a group called The Sinx. Ezra calls it the Remembering Game. Kate talks about her mushroom-based remedy for memory, and they take off again. Will recounts that the Radvinsky Center offers money for completion of a series of short tasks run by the university. He then talks about a book he read about two people named Mimi and Jen. All book choices are about them. So, like, the remembering game is, like, you have to, like... it's just like a sequence, like basically like you have to remember a sequence of things. Mm-hmm. So it's like Ace of Diamonds, Two of Hearts, and then the next person will be like Ace of Diamonds, Two of Hearts, Three of Clubs, and the next person will be Ace of Diamonds, Two of Hearts, Three of Clubs, Four of Spades, and then so on and so forth. It's very simple.
Okay.
The player chooses between a nap and Ezra helping Kate hunt for mushrooms.
I did mushrooms.
I also did mushrooms. Kate teaches Ezra about different kinds of mushrooms, and he gets to try a few. The first rule of mushroom hunting is to ask Kate if it's edible before trying one. And the second rule is to have fun. She tells Ezra to fill the bag with any mushroom he wants, and they will analyze them together after. They both have an introspective moment there of their own at either side of the grove. Kate recalls visiting the hospital after the flood and having a few smokes outside the building. Ezra recalls his time at home when he had his family. He didn't like to play inside as it was too cold all the time and preferred the woods. His father sold windows and his mother worked at a bakery in Parr. Kate left home when she was young and almost had a baby. Now she helps other women with their difficult pregnancies. She took up learning about mushrooms and their medical uses as a hobby. Her family is the Mucky Mammoth and the passengers now, as they talk an old battleship covered in cast drifts by the Iron Pariah. This is an interesting scene because, like, it basically puts up two different text boxes that you have to, mm-hmm. like, go through both of them. And it's like, here's what's happening with Kate. Here's what's happening with Ezra. And, like, you learn both, like, backgrounds about both these characters. Especially, like, Ezra, where he's, like, been abandoned by his family. And that's why he's kind of, like, on his own with a big bird.
Big bird. I also like the big abandoned ship that they're like, some people think that it might have been like a Confederate warship that like people defected and it's just there now. Mm-hmm. And like it was really cool that they were talking about like where it might have come from.
Yeah.
As it just like floated by decrepit with like animals crawling all over it.
Yeah. If the player chooses to stay on board, Kate asks Ezra to wake Will to man the ship while she goes to collect mushrooms. Ezra records more sound samples, including one of Will's cassette player playing a man talking about psychic investigation and Edison's theories. Life units scatter at death and recombine into new life, carrying with them memory fragments. A flower could contain a memory of war in this respect. It was from a class, and the tape was labeled History of the Philosophy of Death. Will then tells Ezra about his dream of being a cat aboard the roaming Iron Pariah. The crewmen fell into despair and used up all their resources, drinking and fading away into silence. After the boat sets off, Will mentions the mushrooms Kate brought back on board and how the cypress trees they grow on and near were planted there as some kind of memorial. No one remembers what the memorial is for. The player chooses to have Shannon help cook or to go out and deliver a package. Do you remember what you did here?
Is this like the package?
The package, like, package.
In the tunnel?
Yes.
Yeah, I did that.
Yeah, same. Shannon and Conway are told, this is if you go do the package, Shannon and Conway are told to pass through a bat sanctuary to get to the exchange, which has been since renamed Consolidated Auxiliary Switch Number 30 since the power company took over, to make a delivery to Poppy, the operator. They will then rendezvous with the mammoth at Sam and Ida's on the other side for breakfast. They first encounter a shrine to the miners lost in the flood, made by the surviving miners, a central pile of helmets surrounded by more helmets floating all around it in the water. This is a very powerful scene.
It really is. And like the text on the memorial is like, it's straight up angry. And I was happy for that because like they even say like, we don't know how many lost. Like, this is your fault.
Yeah. And it's like, if you ever come and try and take one of these helmets away, you will never be able to do that because we will prevent you from ever being able to do that.
It's intense.
It's very intense. The plaque blames the power company for trading safety of the miners for more profit. The helmets are to honor the loss as well as mark their watery graves. As they drift away, Conway waves a skeletal arm at two skeletal figures passing by in a small boat. He says his arm and leg don't bother him anymore, and the guys at the distillery can get together a plan for his debt repayment and consolidate it. He decides to leave Ira's old delivery truck to Shannon. Bat fact! Bats talk with their mouths full. At the sanctuary, the bats eat captured moths and hyperallergenic antiseptic pseudomoths. Shannon and Conway talk about a few things, like Lizette's illness and who Shannon was speaking to on the phone in the mine. Just beyond the sanctuary, Shannon sees Flora, the young girl from the Museum of Dwellings. She was there to retrieve her paper boat, as she is a romantic. An old man named Dashiell Morse is working at a reception desk trying to repair old phones. He says the place used to be a train station before the river washed it all away. The Bureau reclaimed the empty space for the phone company. He mentioned working on wiring at WEVP with some others, one of which was Weaver. Poppy says that Dashiell actually isn't employed with them anymore, but is allowed to keep working as a hobby. The power company fired most of its staff as they brought up all the phone lines. They made a mess of things, trying to automate everything, but someone was still needed. Like overworked Poppy during the job of 13 people. Three skeletal figures pass by in a boat, one of which is Conway, fully transformed into a magnetic skeleton like the rest of the hard-time workers. The player controlling the dog can choose to have the dog either follow his master one last time, or return to the mucky mammoth of Shannon. This whole bit is just, man.
Yeah.
A lot. Like, the whole bit with, like, Poppy where she's, like, talking about, like, oh, yeah, they just did all this automation stuff, and, like, yeah, it's weird that, like, I still have to be here, and oh my god, why am I still here? Why am I still doing this? Why am I still clinging to this company? What am I doing with my life?
But at the same time, like, they kept reducing the people and kept having her do more work and more work and more work, and it's mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm, yeah, yeah, about that. And the like, the whole thing about the old man who, like, he doesn't even have a job there anymore, they just let him come, like...
Yeah. And, like, the whole time you're, like, Conway's just on the boat. Shannon's just doing this, like, she's walking by herself, and it's very dark. The only thing that's lit up is, like, the pathway that you can find. And then once you see that boat, like, walk, like, float on with three people on it, and you're just like,
yep. Yep.
That's the last you ever see of Conway.
Yep, Conway's gone.
For good.
Yeah, you never see him again, which, like, that's interesting that, like, your quote-unquote main character is just gone now.
Yeah, right? Man.
He's a slave to the debt.
He is a slave to the debt.
So let's go eat breakfast.
So, like, you
seafood
you,
or whatever.
Yeah, so, like, you had seen some of that, like, you had seen some of that kind of coming up, because you had seen the scene where, like, he's talking with some other skeleton figures.
Yeah.
I didn't see any of that, so, like, once that happened, I was like, oh.
Yeah, he was talking to the skeletons outside at the, like, cash center. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then when this happened, I'm like, oh, no, they got him. They got him.
Yeah. So, like, for me, it was even more shocking. I was like, oh, he's just gone. They just got him. Oh, no. It's rough.
Rip.
If the player chooses to stay on board, Will is cooking a mysterious mushroom stew for tomorrow. Ezra records more sounds. Will learned the recipe from Ida, but only under the condition he immediately forget it. He trained rigorously in the art of forgetting. Kate interrupts to ask Shannon if she and Conway mind taking delivery in the dinghy, since the boat can't go through narrow passages. Steen goes to delivering a package route, so you basically have to go that way anyways, regardless.
Oh, okay. I mean, that makes sense, because that's a pretty big narrative piece there.
Shannon meets up back with the Mammoth crew at the restaurant on Lake Leth, but Conway is nowhere to be found. He was taken by a distillery workers to start his new job. Johnny helps Ezra play a claw machine game. He can try for an octopus, clamshells, a cowboy hat, or headphones. Headphones can be won. Ida tells Ezra about the dinner preserved on the table and the story of how she and her husband Sam were inspired by the divers who ate there, which became a turning point in their career. Sam listened to the divers compete with grand fishing stories and made a mental map of where to actually catch fish, and he used that information for the next 15 years to supply the restaurant. He returns with one small fish in hand. He's afraid he could die any day following a false story told for the sake of winning the competition. The scene closes to the tune of "This World Is Not My Home" by the traveling band in the foreground as Shannon gets back on the Mammoth and they set off again.
I did think one thing that was interesting about the whole, like, seafood restaurant is that the two of them had very different stories of how it went down. Because she was saying, you know, oh, they were super hungry, and so I kept just coming up with recipes and having to feed them, and then you go down there and he's like, yeah, no, they were done. I just kept wanting them to talk, so I kept ordering things.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, wow, all right.
It's a very different in perspective there.
Yeah.
Then we go to a neighborhood. The crew stops at a houseboat neighborhood to see Clara's theremin performance, which, yeah, theremin performance, cool. Johnny and Junebug reminisce about a time they saw her perform before, where she played at a flower shop. Cyrano opened for her act by playing the lap steel, but he was having a hard time. Junebug thinks over the details of that night and her relationship with Johnny. Clara's playing the theremin in the greenhouse caused the glass to shake and made everyone uneasy, but no harm was done by the end. Johnny brings up the possibility of having Ezra join them, and Junebug worries that they will do their relationship. What that will do to their relationship that they built together from simple robots to unique individuals. She later says that they could teach him to use the drum machine and contribute to the band. After the performance, the Mammoth sets off once more, and everyone disembarked. It appears the old hound stays on board. They had to push the old truck as it wouldn't start. Clara decided to travel with them for a bit. And then finally, the group realizes the spiral staircase around them is the only path available at the Silo of Late Reflections, and there's no way to bring the truck along. They will have to carry the delivery on foot. Ezra takes the lead to check out what the truck has been carrying. End of Act 4.
The end.
And then we get the penultimate interlude, which is called Un Pueblo de Nada, which takes place at a broadcast from WEVP-TV. Where you get to play as Emily. Apparently there's a live-action recording of the show.
Really?
You go to WEVP.TV.
Oh, wow.
It's cool. This is, again, one of the weird things, or one of the more wild things, where, the gameplay just very much changes. Where, you were playing as Emily from, a behind-the-back third-person perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting. Let's see here. You meet a bunch of characters that are working on the community show. Rita hosts a show. Maya shows up as a guest. Ron brings in a tape he calls Wild. Jeff calls in. Bob and Ben repair a radio for ghost hunting. Mo the crow manages the tape playback, which is a literal crow.
It's Cyrano, super cool.
Yeah, Cyrano and Elmo do the weather. Nikki enters late in the broadcast to read her poetry. We learn from Act 4 that WEVP-TV was destroyed during a flood and that Weaver's broadcast interruption was the last thing to air before its destruction. The crash sound implies that this is what happens at the end of the interlude, which explains why Emily, Ben, and Bob are experienced as ghosts during the acts. Additionally, the game and the ancillary videos make reference to a then-recent murder of an out-of-towner. Nikki's poem at the end of the broadcast and Emily's conversation with Slow-Mo, the crow, both make references to it, as do the Aunt Connie's PSAs. As with Here and There Along the Echo, you can call a phone number, which I guess I could just say on this, 1-270-301-5797, to listen to a recording and leave a message. When observing Bob and Ben with the radio, they refer to it as a ghost box, referencing Ghost Box Records.
Oh.
A favorite label of the late cultural theorist Mark Fisher, he wrote about the hauntological qualities of the music released by Ghost Box. The player at one point is given the option to choose between the remarks weird or eerie, and in reference to Fisher's final books, The Weird and the Eerie. So yeah, it's basically you just sit around and watch this final
broadcast.
Yes, broadcast of this little community television station before this big storm just envelops it and just destroys the entire building and everything around it.
And you get hints throughout that things are getting worse, because at first there's a leak in the roof, and then if you look down at certain points, she's like, oh, it's coming up to my boot. And she more and more comments on how high the water is getting.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, oh no.
This was released in January of 2018. And then we get to Act 5.
All right.
The final act released in January 2020. It is, again, a very interesting idea of how to finish this act, or finish this game. Because this whole time you have been playing as all these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And for Act 5, you play as a cat.
Yep.
Running around, seeing all these characters.
In a very bright area, which is very opposite of what you've been in.
Yeah. So you are in the aftermath of that storm that was in the interlude, where you meet up with Emily and all the characters from the WEVP television station. Shannon and everyone has come up here, and this is Dogwood Drive.
Yep.
This is it. They have found it. And they finally find the location, and it's just the shell of a house.
Yeah, it's got two walls and a roof.
Yeah.
And a foundation.
So essentially you go around as this cat and you see people talking. You see all these scenes with everyone just intermingling with each other. You learn about where this town is, how it was the town with no roads and no roads coming into it or anything like that. How they're dealing with this flood that just happened, how they're trying to survive in this. And a lot of it is also being the power company came in and took over a lot of the town and everything. Where are they? Why aren't they coming to help us?
Yep. Which,
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't go fully in-depth into everything, but Act 5 of Kentucky Route Zero shows the group dealing with a flood and organizing the town around Dogwood Drive. house to deal with it. Many people are bound to leave it due to not wanting anything to do with it, and the player controls a cat and a dragonfly to navigate. Past echoes are present of when people were still living around the big hole in the ground, and Ron has to deal with the neighbors and bury them after they drowned in the flood. The neighbors are horses. They just call them the neighbors because they're just around.
Yep.
The act ends with everyone reunited and mourning the horses with a song in the end, and the player chooses who stays and who leaves. But past echoes all gather together to mourn their loss, and people discuss their current state and how to deal with life from there on. The game ends there as the camera pans out of view, and Emily is last seen finishing the mourning song for the neighbors, the silver one, and the other one. Like, that mourning scene is just really powerful as well, because, like, you just see all these, like, images or, like, these shadows, like, show up of, like, here are people who used to live here, who are people who used to be here, coming to like join up in this community, like shows like just like the power of like this used to be a huge community and now it's dwindling. Now it's just, like, everyone just like is going to go their separate ways because they have to at this point.
Yeah, the shadow people moving around the town was really wild.
Mm-hmm. A few things I have to ask. Did you have Ezra join up with Junebug and Johnny?
Yes.
Okay, same. That was, like, a decision I was, like, kind of debating all the way up until the end there, because I was, like, would these characters do this or not? And then finally, like, at the end, like, they have, like, I think Johnny asks them, he's like, you want to come join up with us? And I was, like, yeah, this seems like the appropriate thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
I wanted him to have a family.
Yeah. Same, basically. Did you have Emily stay or leave?
I don't remember.
I think hers was more ambiguous for me because, like, I was like, she's going to help people leave and then decide later on. Like, she's going to help people get out and then figure out if she wants to stay or not once that's all done.
Maybe that's what happened because I don't remember a definitive either way.
Mm-hmm. And then basically, like, the last shot you see of the game is, like, Shannon and her crew, along with some of the others who are sticking around, they put the delivery into the Dogwood Drive house and are now just kind of, like, setting up there now.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, like, we talked about this for Game of the Year, but, like, this is a game that really just harps on the fact of, like, you know, bad things happen to good people, and, like, life beats you down a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, Act 5, as much as, like, it's sad and everything, like, the way it ends is just, like, here is this beacon of hope that you can have. Here is this thing you should, like, that is going to come into the face of everything else that's in this game that has been bad for you and everything. Like, here is this one glimpse of hope that you want to fight for, that you want to protect and everything, that you want to build a future around. And it's just, like, it's amazing how, like, they're able to wrap it up like that.
And even small details, like, there's this one really cute scene where, I forget who it was, but they're with Johnny, and they're like, hey, I can teach you how to make, like, the best waffles. And Johnny's like, I can't eat them, but I still want to learn. And I was like, that's so cute that, like, they're all trying to work together to, mm-hmm. to make everything better, even if it doesn't benefit them.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have the positive here of that, you know, everything's kind of wiped clean, but the power company's gone, so you can do what you can
start fresh.
Yeah. Rip the neighbors.
Poor horses.
Horses.
There is a final interlude if you have met some requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Which I didn't. You did. I was like, wait, what is this?
I did by accident.
What did you do?
Super duper accident.
The final first interlude of the game has players manipulating the dials of a television as Carrington speaks to Harry and later Emily at where is presumably the lower depths from Act 3 and is fictionally featured in the entertainment. The characters discuss Carrington's play, the poem it is based on, and Harry's relationship to his help, occasionally commenting on what the player has tuned in on the television. The element within the scene...
There's also a drinking bird next to
it. The element within the scene included a deck of cards on top of an open book of crossword puzzles, on top of the Bible, the television, and a drinking bird toy with the glass of water. A lot of this revolves around a poem.
Yes.
Called The Death of the Hired Man by Robert Frost. Would you like me to read you this poem?
I would.
We are going longer than I expected on this podcast, but oh well.
Whoops.
Let's do some poetry.
I also have a question after this, so...
Okay. Mary sat musing on the lamp flame at the table, waiting for Warren. When she heard his step, she ran on tiptoe down the darkened passage to meet him in the doorway with the news and put him on his guard. Silas is back. She pushed him outward with her through the door and shut it after her. Be kind, she said. She took the market things from Warren's arms and set him on the porch, then drew him down to sit beside her on the wooden steps. When was I ever anything but kind to him? But I'll not have the fellow back, he said. I told him so last haying, didn't I? If he left then, I said, that ended it. What good is he? Who else will harbor him, at his age, for the little he can do? What help he is, there's no depending on. Off he goes always when I need him most. He thinks he ought to earn a little pay, enough at least to buy tobacco with, so he won't have to beg and be beholden. All right, I say. I can't afford to pay any fixed wages, though I wish I could. Someone else can. Then someone else will have to. I shouldn't mind his bettering himself, if that's what it was. You can be certain, when he begins like that, there's someone at him, trying to coax him with pocket money, and hang time when any help is scarce. And winter comes back to us, I'm done. Shh, not so loud. He'll hear you, Mary said. I want him to. He'll have to sooner or late. He's worn out. He's asleep behind the stove. When I come up from Rose, I found him here, huddled against the barn door, fast asleep. A miserable sight and frightening, too. You needn't smile. I didn't recognize him. I wasn't looking for him. And he's changed. Wait till you see. Where did you say he'd been? He didn't say. I dragged him to the house and gave him tea and tried to make him smoke. I tried to make him talk about his travels. Nothing would do. He just kept nodding off. What did he say? Did he say anything? But little. Anything? Mary, confess, he said he'd come to ditch the meadow for me. Warren! But did he? I just want to know. Of course he did. What would you have him say? Surely you wouldn't grudge the poor old man some humble way to save his self-respect. He added, if you really cared to know, he meant to clear the upper pasture too. That sounds like something you have heard before. Warren, I wish you could have heard the way he jumbled everything. I stopped to look two or three times. He made me feel so queer, to see if he was talking in his sleep. He ran on Harold Wilson, you remember, the boy you had in haying 4 years since. He's finished school and teaches in his college. Silas declares you'll have to get him back. He says they too will make a team for work. Between them, they will lay this farm as smooth. The way he mixed that in with other things. He thinks young Wilson a likely lad, though daft on education. You know how they fought. All through July under the blazing sun. Silas up on the cart to build the load. Harold along beside to pitch it on. Yes, I took care to keep well out of earshot. Well, those days trouble Silas like a dream. You wouldn't think they would. How some things linger. Harold's young college boy's assurance piqued him. After so many years, he still keeps finding good arguments he sees he might have used. I sympathize. I just know how it feels to think of the right thing to say too late. Harold's associated it in his mind with Latin. He asked me what I thought of Harold saying he studied Latin like the violin because he liked it. That an argument. He said he couldn't make the boy believe. He couldn't find water with the hazel prong, which showed him how much good school had ever done for him. He wanted to go over that. But most of all, he thinks if he could have another chance to teach him how to build a load of hay. I know that Silas is one accomplishment. He bundles every forkful in its place and tags and numbers it for future reference, so he can find and easily dislodge it in the unloading. Silas does that well. He takes it out in the bunches, like big bird's nest. You never see him standing on the hay. He's trying to lift, straining to lift himself. He thinks if he could teach him that, he'd be some good perhaps as someone in the world. He hates to see a boy the fool of books. Poor Silas, so concerned for other folk, and nothing to look backward to with pride, and nothing to look forward to with hope, so now and never any different. Part of a moon was falling down the west, dragging the whole sky with it to the hills. Its light poured softly in her lap. She saw it and spread her apron to it. She put out her hand, among the harp-like morning glory strings, taut with the dew from the garden bed to eaves, as if she played unheard some tenderness that wrought on him beside her in the night. Warren, she said, he has come home to die. You needn't be afraid he'll leave you this time. Home, he mocked gently. Yes, what else but home? It all depends on what you mean by home. Of course he's nothing to us, any more than was the hound that came a stranger to us, out of the woods, worn out upon the trail. Home is the place where you have to go there. They have to take you in. I should have called it something you somehow haven't to deserve. Warren leaned out and took a step or two, picked up a little stick and brought it back, and broke it in his hand and tossed it by. Silas has better claim on us, you think, than on his brother. 13 little miles as the road winds would bring him to his door. Silas has walked that far, no doubt, today. Why didn't he go there? His brother's rich, a somebody, director in the bank. He never told us that. We know it, though. I think his brother ought to help, of course. I'll see to it if there is need. He ought of right to take him in and might be willing to. He may be better than appearances. But have some pity on Silas. Do you think if he'd had any pride in claiming kin, or anything he looked for from his brother, he'd keep so still about him all this time? I wonder what's between them. I can tell you, Silas is what he is. We wouldn't mind him, but just the kind that kinsfolk can't abide. He never did a thing so very bad. He don't know why he isn't quite as good as anyone. Worthless though he is, he won't be made ashamed to please his brother. I can't think Cy ever hurt anyone. No, but he hurt my heart the way he lay and rolled his old head on that sharp-edged chair back. He wouldn't let me put him on the lounge. You must go in and see what you can do. I made the bed up for him there tonight. You'll be surprised at him. How much he's broken. His working days are done, I'm sure of it. I'd not be in a hurry to say that. I haven't been. Go look see for yourself. But Warren, please remember how it is. He's come to help you ditch the meadow. He has a plan. You mustn't laugh at him. He may not speak of it, and then he may. I'll sit and see if that small sailing cloud will hit or miss the moon. It hit the moon. Then there were three there making a dim row. The moon, the little silver cloud, and she. Warren returned too soon, it seemed to her, slipped to her side, caught up her and waited. Warren, she questioned. Dead was all he answered. That's a poem.
That is a poem.
What was your question?
Unrelated to that. the out-of-towner.
Mm-hmm.
I know basically nothing about him. Who is this guy?
I don't know.
And, like, did he get murdered? Did he get worked to death? How did he die?
That's a great question.
Like, I didn't learn anything about him, and I wanted to learn about him.
Let me know about this out-of-towner.
And I thought that maybe I missed something and that you got it.
No.
Okay, well, maybe we just don't learn about the out-of-towner.
We're just missing out, clearly.
Bummer. He just seemed like a plot point since he was mentioned several times. And I was like, who are you?
Who knows? Who are you?
Dead.
But yeah, like the final interlude is basically just that poem, but yep. In the context of the game. And they even go so far as to like reference it. And they talk about like scroll. And try and find it. They talk about the lines about like what home is. Specifically, mm-hmm. the line that's, home is the place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in. And yeah. Carrington's like, oh, you know, that's very literal. That, you know, Frost is basically saying, you know, home is where you go, people take you in, and you feel comfortable. And, like, some of the other characters are like, I don't know about that. Like, who else is there? Harry's kind of like, I don't know if that's really as literal as this. And then Emily comes in. Later, like at the very end, and he's like, they're like talking about that again, and she's like, I don't think he means home, I think he means the grave.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I love anything that kind of just like brings in like, let's just have some cool literary analysis conversations. And like that's just what this interlude turns into. Yep. Near the latter half of it. Yeah, it's cool. I like it.
Twisting dials and
yeah,
NASCAR's going on.
Yep.
And knives.
Knife in the knife channel. Got to watch the knife channel. That's Kentucky Route Zero then.
Yep.
It's a, man, it's a heck of a game. It is a heck of a game. It's a, I saw this on Twitter and I very much agree with it, but like, it's a shame that like in 2020, we've seen games like big AAA games who have had a lot of controversies around them, like with, you know, the way that they have treated their employees and stuff with regards to crunch and everything, be lauded as like these huge just pillars of video games and like how they're basically art.
Yep.
And all this sort of stuff, when like this is a game that rarely ever comes along, and quite frankly, if you want to call this game art, I would not tell you no.
Yeah.
This is a masterclass in terms of narrative design, in terms of narrative writing, in a way that a lot of games just don't ever reach. And it's a shame that, like, we're going to put, you know, these other games on top of this one. Like, this is the game that, like, this is a game that when you go to, like, game design courses in college, that should be studied. Like, maybe some people might think that, oh, that's very hyperbolic, but that's just what I think, so. You can take that for what it's worth.
I mean, I would definitely recommend this over some of the other major releases of 2020 that we're not going to mention the titles. They don't deserve to be mentioned.
But yeah, this game's great.
Yeah, it was really good.
I cannot. Powered through it. It's a game you could power through, and I don't think that really takes away from the overall story itself.
No, I explored a lot.
Mm-hmm. It's a heck of a game that you can basically play on a whole lot of things now. Like originally, of course, it was on PC and Mac and Linux and all that sort of stuff. Now you can get it on Switch, PS4, and Xbox One. So, like, and there's really no excuse to not play it.
It's not like a very taxing game either. So, like,
no, like, if you have like a bad computer, you could probably play this game. Even then, like, it plays really well on consoles because, like, the controls.
Yeah, the Switch version was great.
Are totally fine and everything. So, yeah. It is a wonderful, wonderful video game.
Can recommend.
It's a game a year from now I will probably be classifying as the big M word.
The big what?
The big M word.
M word?
Yes. A masterpiece.
Oh. That makes sense. I was like, what M word?
So yeah, that's our big talk about Kentucky Route Zero, which I'm sure a lot of people came out of Game of the Year were like, huh?
Yeah.
You guys didn't talk about this at all last year. When did this come around? And it's because I literally played it in the week leading up to me writing Game of the Year, so. It was literally the last game I put off playing for whatever reason, and like I finally got around to it. I was like, why did I put off playing this? That was stupid. I've had this since January. Why did I take so long? But yeah. That is the tales of Kentucky Route Zero and Donkey Kong Country 3. Two very similar games.
Super similar.
In all aspects.
The only similarities that we really have are that I played them both on the Switch.
Yeah, there you go. Both Switch games. Similarities.
Yep.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode.
Yeah.
So if you'd like more from us, go to SeasonalAnimeCheckup.com or SSC.cool, so where you can find past episodes of this podcast and other podcasts like Season Anime Checkup, Jared Now Watch. You can also find columns and reviews on the site as well. If you want more from Ann Ladium, go to AnnLadium.com. She's got columns and reviews. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/AnimeCheckup. Buy our books, One Shining Moment, A Critical Analysis of Love, Life, Sunshine, and Hot Tubs and Pac-Man on Amazon.com. And you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/SACOVA. Buy us a slice of pizza. Get access to unedited versions of the podcast early, bonus episodes, fun stuff like that. Next week, we will continue... Clean up from 2020 and unburying some of the other games that we played or just whatnot. So, a whole bunch of that. Tomorrow is Al's birthday.
Oh, I forgot about that.
So wish her a happy birthday when you listen to this, even if it's like a year later.
Yay.
Or like 6 months later. Just be like, hey, happy birthday.
I'll be like, thank you. I appreciate that. What a kind human being you are.